LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Walter Cruttendon, who joins us to discuss his book, Lost Star of Myth and Time. The myth and folklore of ancestral peoples around the world hints at a vast cycle of time, with alternating dark and golden ages. Plato called it the Great Year. Long believed to be a fairy tale, there is now new astronomical evidence to show that it has a basis in fact. Moreover, because it's caused by the acceleration of our sun around another star, we learn that the Earth should soon be carried into a region of space that will have a beneficial effect on our atmosphere, nudging mankind into a higher state of consciousness. Lost Star of Myth and Time weaves together some of the latest archaeological evidence with cutting-edge astronomy to reveal a history of the world that finally fits with myth, folklore, and the archaeological record. While the book explores some of the most interesting aspects of a once advanced civilization that covered the Earth, it's really about what happens to the Earth and consciousness as our solar system moves through space in the mysterious motion known as the precession of the equinox. Since the days of Isaac Newton, this astronomical phenomenon has been attributed to local gravitational forces wobbling the Earth's axis. Lost Star now shows, in no uncertain terms, that the Earth's axis does not change orientation relative to objects inside the solar system at the same rate as it changes orientation to objects outside the solar system. This means that precession must be due to our sun's binary motion around another star. Chapter by chapter, it becomes clear that ancient cultures knew about precession, used it as the clock of the ages, understood it to be due to the solar system's motion through space, and realized that this subjects the Earth to a cycle of waxing and waning stellar influences. It is these forces that affect our magnetosphere, ionosphere, and indirectly create the larger seasons of the Great Year. This not only gives cause for a major rethink of human history and potential, but indicates that we are approaching a tipping point in the awakening of consciousness. Hello and welcome, Walter, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
My pleasure to be with you, Greg.
Now, Walter, today we're going to discuss some of the ideas in a book you published a few years ago called Lost Star of Myth and Time. Before we get into that, perhaps you could just give listeners a little bit about your background, how you came to be doing this work in the first place, and then just a little overview of the whole proposition in the book.
Sure. Well, I'm a director of the Binary Research Institute here in California, and this is where we look at the cause and consequences of solar system motion. And I've been doing this work for about, 12 years or so. And it's was primarily initiated by some reading I did maybe 20 years ago that had me question the current theories of history. And by that I mean, you know, we're taught in school that history is pretty linear, that it just moves up gradually, and that whatever came before us must be more primitive. But the more I read about very distant ancient cultures, sort of pre-Dark Age cultures, the more I realized that many of them were quite advanced. And by that, I mean there was a knowledge of astronomy, mathematics, different healing techniques. The ancient cities of Sumer, Akkad, Babylon—they were very advanced. They had sewer systems, indoor plumbing, and in many places we find same thing in the Indus Valley. Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro—they built with uniform bricks. They had again indoor heating in some places, and so I just question this whole idea of history. And then when I read a book called The Holy Science by Sri Yukteswar, it was the first time I'd ever realized that there might be a theory to explain this. And so that's kind of what got me going on this whole thing. And here I am today.
Now, in the book, you present a quite radical, by mainstream conventions, theory about world ages. And this relates to a lot of common myths that go back as far back as we know, telling us that in the cyclical versus linear time, cyclical is actually the one that applies. And of course, this has been written off, generally speaking, by modern scholars as being just that, myths. And as you mentioned earlier, that these earlier civilizations, whatever innovations they had along the lines you just mentioned, fundamentally, they must have been more primitive, if not in their architecture or whatever, certainly in their way of thinking. But this does not stack up, really. And in the book, you go through and pick all this apart and make a, as I say, radical but very complete suggestion about how, what our place, the Earth's place in the solar system and the solar system's place in the wider galaxy.
Yes. Well, there's, you know, there's so much evidence. And when you start to piece it together, it does make a compelling case. But, you know, one obvious piece of information is that ancient cultures all around the world spoke of this vast cycle of time with alternating dark and golden ages. You know, Plato called it the Great Year. I made a film with that name. And most of us were taught that it was just a myth, a fairy tale. And that's, you know, if we were taught anything at all about it. Many history courses don't teach about pre-Dark Age cultures. But according to Giorgio de Santayana, who's the former professor of the history of science at MIT, he taught at Harvard, I mean, just a terrific scholar. He said that many ancient cultures, in fact, he documented over 30 that showed that believed that consciousness and history were not linear but cyclical. In other words, they talked about a rising and a falling age over very long periods of time. And this is really well annotated in the book that he authored called Hamlet's Mill. He actually co-authored it along with Hertha von Deschen, who's a great scientist in her own right from Goethe University. And they show that the myth and folklore of all these ancient cultures from Nordic to Polynesian to Indian to Greeks, et cetera, talks about this cycle of time with long periods of enlightenment broken by dark ages of ignorance. And it was often, very often, indirectly tied to or driven by known astronomical phenomena. And of course, that's where it gets very interesting.
Yes. Now, you mentioned astronomical phenomena, and this clue in this to this cycle of the ages came from something called the precession of the equinox. So perhaps you could just explain for people who don't know what that is and what the mainstream view of what causes it, but and also your alternative idea.
Gladly. In order for people to understand precession, let me just talk about the Earth's other two motions. Precession is considered the Earth's third motion, according to Copernicus. And we're all familiar with these first two motions. The first one is called the diurnal motion, which is simply the Earth rotating on its axis. And as it spins completely around every 24 hours relative to the sun, you have, of course, night and day, darkness and light. And our bodies are adapted to that motion. You know, when we're approaching the electromagnetic spectrum of the sun, our bodies tend to move from a subconscious state to a waking state. A lot of activity takes place, not just in our bodies, but on the whole planet. Photosynthesis occurs and just everything's more active. And then when we turn away from the sun, you know, life is adapted to, you know, get quieter. Most of us go into a subconscious dream state for, you know, 7 or 8 hours each night. And that's how profoundly this first motion of the earth affects us. The second motion of the earth is just as profound. We all know it well. It's called the earth's revolution around the sun. And, you know, it takes 365 days to do one complete circuit. And in this period of time, of course, the hemisphere that is facing the sun, you know, getting more of the sun's electromagnetic spectrum per square inch, enlivens, and it goes through the spring and plants bloom, you know, trillions of things come out of the ground and give their fruit, and other things come out of hibernation, other things spawn or migrate in mass. It has this massive, massive effect all over the earth. And then, of course, as that hemisphere goes away from the sun, everything happens in reverse. You know, the plants begin to decay, things go back into hibernation, the planet gets quiet on that side of the earth, on that hemisphere. And so we know that these first two motions have a big effect, and they're very visible motions. You know, the rotation you see with the sun and the stars rising in the east, setting in the west, and the same thing during the Earth's revolution. You can notice a different constellation overhead roughly once a month of the 12 ancient constellations. You know, Leo, Taurus, Pisces, etc. There'll be roughly a different one overhead each month. And so that's how we kind of observe them from an astral standpoint, if you will. So precession then is a very similar motion, but instead of it taking one day or 1 year, it takes what Plato called one great year, a period of roughly 24,000 years. And during this period of time, we can see that the equinox, which say falls in Aries, the spring equinox, a couple thousand years ago, and then was in Pisces. It's now in Pisces and will soon be in Aquarius. That this gradual precession of the equinox through the 12 constellations of the zodiac takes place. And right now, most of us don't associate any change in consciousness that goes along with that, as we have this, or changes in earth life at all. It's something we hardly notice, and because it's so slow. It takes about 50 arc seconds. That's the amount of motion you see in 1 year. And so at that rate, you know, you get 30 arc seconds of sky in 2,000 years. It takes, again, 24,000 years to go, 30 degrees in 2,000 years. So it takes 24,000 years to go 360 degrees. But it can be observed. And the ancients would tell us that, you know, during this period of time, there would be very, very big changes on the earth. And of course, that's all just myth now, but I'm seeing more and more evidence that indicates the ancients may indeed be correct.
Now, another part of your proposition, and we'll go back to the title of the book again, The Lost Star of Myth and Time. And the lost star basically refers to a sister sun to our own, which would, if it existed, would mean that we're part of a binary star system. Now, before I looked into this, I thought, well, yes, I've heard of that, but you know, they're probably rare. But turns out they're actually more common than what we believe, or what a lot of people believe we've got at the minute, which is a single star system.
Yeah, that's very true, Greg. I think when I was a kid, they thought, you know, maybe half the stars were in binary systems. Nowadays, we're finding so many brown dwarfs and, you know, red dwarfs, small stars, that they think it might be upwards of 80% of all stars are in either binary or multiple star relationships. This means that stars like companions almost more than humans do. And it just means two stars that are gravitationally bound, two or more. And so, yes, they are very, very common. And yet, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, this information was hardly known at all. If you looked up and you happened to see two stars that were close to each other, you just figured that's the way they appeared in the sky. But you're right. There's a lot of stars that are in binary relationships. And why this is important to this understanding of history is that the current theory of precession says that we see the phenomena of precession, in other words, the equinox appearing to go through all 12 constellations over a 24,000-year period or so, due to the fact that the Earth wobbles. And Newton, in fact, said it was due to the forces of the sun and the moon, the gravitational forces acting upon the oblate Earth. And that is still the accepted theory today. But ancients referred to there possibly being another star. And in fact, if that was the cause of precession, you would have the same exact observable where we see these, different constellations overhead. But it's not caused so much by the Earth wobbling. Sure, the Earth would still wobble a little bit, but this main phenomena of precession would be caused by basically the whole solar system going in this vast orbit around another star. And we think there's just a ton of proof for that, and that's a lot of the work we do at the Binary Research Institute is to show how this model of precession works better using a binary star hypothesis than it does to use a wobbling Earth hypothesis. A matter of fact, precession, it's a very complicated subject, and so most people don't study it at all, but the current theory of precession just has tons of problems in it, this wobbling Earth theory, so much so that the Astronomical Union has basically said that the old precession theory is inconsistent with dynamical theory. And that's a fancy way of saying it's broken. And so what they do every 10 years or so is they change the inputs and try to clean up the old precession theory to make it match the observable, because the precession rate's changing each year. And so it just doesn't work. And we think the binary theory is a much better way to look at it. In fact, it's so much more accurate. We've written a paper on this, and it shows it's about 43 times more accurate in predicting changes in the rate of precession over the last few hundred years.
Now, one thing that pops up, which is quite staggering, is if precession takes place over a period of 24,000 years and has been measured, observed, as it were, that would suggest then that, first of all, that's a staggering feat, because we look at human beings today and we're so short term in our thinking, and as far as handing things down to other generations, nobody seems to care much about that anymore. So obviously we must have thought differently at one time. Then there's the idea that it would have to occur more than once, because if you observe something happening over a period of time, however long it is, you can't call it a cycle or observe a pattern in it until you watch it again. And maybe again, I don't know how often scientists would repeat experiments before they were satisfied with the results. But that in itself is amazing. And that also then says something about the conventional notions of how long man has been on the planet and how long we've been civilized.
You're making a great point. Yeah. Our current notions of history go back maybe 5,000 years, 6,000 years, something like that, to early Mesopotamia, early Indus Valley. And And that's just because things don't last that much longer. I mean, even things as large as the pyramids start to experience significant erosion. And so our history really doesn't go back that much farther, certainly written history. However, they did find some amazing sites, which we can get into a little later, that were purposely buried, and therefore we do know that we were doing great things for a longer period of time. For example, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, for some reason, was buried about 8,000 to 9,000 years ago, and these beautiful pillars with bas-reliefs would have been, you know, just eroded to dust. You wouldn't even know that the site existed had it not been buried. And that is a culture that predates, for example, ancient Egypt by something like three times. It's very, very significant. And so, yes, it appears that culture go back much farther than we originally perceived, at least that I was taught in school, you know, 30, 40 years ago. But they're kind of always changing. I would say we have sort of we're moving from this notion that we were hunter-gatherers 5,000 years ago to then 7,000 years ago to 9,000 years ago. Now people are pushing it to 12,000 years. And we kind of keep changing our views of history without sort of readdressing the whole theory. But indeed, you're right. If we do have sort of knowledge of different epochs of history, different ages throughout a 24,000-year period, it would suggest that history is much older than we think and, you know, perhaps much different than we think also.
Well, just on that point, I would point listeners to interviews which they can find at legalizefreedom.com with Robert Schock and with Michael Cremo, and they will go into that particular area in more detail if people are interested. But as you were mentioning earlier about scientists changing their views to or theories to fit the observables, that is a major problem really in all of this. And it's, you know, it's a very human problem. And that makes it difficult to get this new information circulating, a new idea circulating. Because even in the light of Göbekli Tepe, which you mentioned, I still see people in the media, TV, radio, newspapers, when they're talking about human history, that, oh, yes, it started 5,000 years ago in Sumer or whatever. At least, you know, there's textbooks out there. Children are being taught a view of history that is admittedly openly incorrect, but still we go on.
Yeah, it takes a while to change all the history books, to change the teachings. You know, many of the history teachers, it was just taught differently when they went to school. And so it'll happen. And, you know, the internet certainly helps. And I just think things are going to be so dramatically different in another decade or two from now, the way we look at ancient cultures. And I think it's important too, because if this idea of cycles is correct, that just as you have daily and yearly cycles, so do you have very long cycles that sort of overlay on evolution, if you will, then it suggests that, you know, you don't just write off primitive cultures, very old cultures as being primitive and therefore nothing to learn. You start to really investigate them and figure out why were they studying the stars in certain ways? Why did they do math in certain ways? Why did they recommend certain ways of, you know, dealing with nature and this sort of thing? And I just think there's a tremendous benefit that can come from reexamining our views on history.
Now, perhaps people are thinking, well, yes, okay, we've
We've heard myths about dark ages. You know, there's one quite recently that we all know about, you know, the dark ages, maybe not the only dark ages, but and lost, you know, and myths of golden ages, ascent of man, the fall of man, you know, relating to the Garden of Eden story. But they say, well, why does this happen and what's it got to do with precession or anything else or a binary star system? And what it basically is, okay, we have the Earth going around the sun, and the sun, the solar system, potentially in a huge orbit of its own. And it's, we all know about the effects of celestial mechanics on different bodies. We can see that. We know the action of the sun and the moon on the Earth. We're very familiar with those, you mentioned earlier. But it's actually other things, other forms of electromagnetism, cosmic rays, all sorts of things that change as the solar system moves through the galaxy. And it's these that actually affect our bodies and our, by extension, our consciousness.
Yes, there's some great work that's been done by Dr. Valerie Hunt at UCLA University, who has showed the effects of electromagnetism on consciousness, if you will. And it's still an area of study in its early stages, but she did some experimentations in a facility there called the Mu Room, and it's basically a Faraday cage, which is these cages with a lot of metal in the walls that are meant to dampen out, you know, radio signals and things like this. And it's where they originally built to, you know, do testing of microcircuits and things like this, where they needed very quiet environments. And she put people in there and had them do tests and work and things and for long periods of time. And she found that when people are completely separated from sort of the natural ambient electromagnetic soup that we all live in every day, which is mostly generated by the sun and the Earth's magnetosphere, when people are separated, they get very upset. They feel threatened. They feel sad. They really don't know why they feel so anxious like this. And it suggests that there's something very beneficial to, you know, just being in a natural environment. And the opposite is true also. She found that when you sort of amp up the negative ions in the atmosphere, that people feel better, more uplifted, this sort of thing. And this can occur naturally in nature too, where, you know, around waterfalls and surf and things like this. And so, yes, there is some very concrete research that's been done to suggest, to sort of show an analogy, if you will, of what might be happening with the Earth over very long periods of time. And so the analogy would be that, you know, if the Earth is carried by the solar system closer to or farther from another source of another electromagnetic source, then just like you have your seasons of the year, you might also have some different type of seasons that are acting on a subtler level over very long periods of time, producing or sort of dampening consciousness, if you will, and then increasing consciousness. And it's really, it's a revolutionary thought, and yet it's a very ancient thought. It's in fact, it's embedded into the teachings of the yugas and the Greeks, and I'd love to get into that with you.
Well, it's also worth mentioning that these effects, electromagnetic effects that you're speaking about, they don't depend on the binary theory. You said it was the Earth or the solar system moving closer to or further away from an electromagnetic source. That doesn't necessarily have to be another star, even though that's your theory.
That's true. You know, it's hard to imagine what could have this effect besides some huge you know, generator of this, of, you know, electromagnetic waves. But I suppose there could, it could be induced some other way. I've just not seen a good hypothesis to explain it any other way.
Oh, I guess my point was that these effects are real. You talked about the work with the, you know, the Faraday cage, that these effects are measurable and we're learning more about them all the time. So it's not a case of saying, oh, well, we don't know if cosmic rays or electromagnetism from space affects us. We don't really, that's kind of, we understand that they do now.
Yeah. And, you know, another example is something called transcranial stimulation, TMS. And this is used on people that have, you know, severe episodes of depression. They found that they can put a pulse magnet near their brain for, you know, an hour or two, and it helps to sync up some of the brain waves and takes people from a very depressed state to, you know, a much more normal state and uplifted state. And so, yeah, there's what we're, our hypothesis is that this is happening not just on this tiny individual level or not just in a room with a few people, but to the entire planet. And in that case, it takes, you know, something much more than just a magnet or, you know, some local source. It would take something significant over long periods of time.
Well, this proposition's pretty damn big, really. You're basically saying that whether it's heaven on earth or hell on earth or somewhere in between, it's looks like it's down to this changing energy that the solar system is bathed in as it moves around the galaxy. And we talked earlier about some of the myths that relate the idea of world ages, you know, rising and falling of fortunes of man. And you mentioned the yugas there, and that's one of the best known texts that sets this out. And it has been regarded, of course, as mythical. So perhaps you just say something about those.
Yes. So the two clearest mythologies regarding these changing ages of time over the precession cycle are probably the Greeks and the Indians, because they broke it into very similar ages. The Greeks called them the Iron, Bronze, Silver, and Golden Age. And the Indians had their similar names for each of these, called the Kali Yuga, the Dwapara Yuga, the Treta Yuga, and the Satya Yuga would be their golden age, with the Kali Yuga being the darkest. And they correspond perfectly. If you look at the mythology related to the Greek ages, they also call them the Age of Man, the Age of the Hero, the Age of the Demigod, and the Age of the Gods. Sort of progressing up from the lowest age of man, to the highest age of the gods. And the Indian culture too, and there's, you know, a lot of different text and folklore about these, but the one that I like the best, some of the clearest teachings, again, come from Sri Yukteswar. But there's also a great book now by Joseph Selby called The Yugas, which really pulls together a lot of the old Indian writings into a cohesive look at the yugas, and shows that the lowest age is considered to be a very material age, one in which mankind only perceives things through the senses, the five senses. And so he perceives the universe as being just physical, if you will. He has no knowledge of finer forces. And so this is what existed during the Dark Ages. And then when mankind starts to wake up a little bit, and we move from the Dark Ages, the awakening was the Renaissance period. And in fact, Renaissance means rebirth, rebirth of the cycle, if you will. And that happened, you know, roughly 1415 through 1700 or so. And this Renaissance was this great awakening. And sure enough, just as the Indians would suggest, man begins to have knowledge of subtler forces. We discover electricity. We discover magnetism. Develop laws of physics. You get farther into it, you start to discover molecules and atoms and electrons and the whole micro cosmic world, if you will. And so the myths regarding this age, from the lowest age to the next one up, seem to match the scientific discoveries in many ways, if you will. And then, of course, the higher ages, the ages that are higher than we are now, because we're just barely out of the Dark Ages, a few hundred years out of the Dark Ages. And yet this cycle goes 12,000 years up, 12,000 years down, are very difficult to understand. They almost sound like magic to us. As a matter of fact, a lot of the mythology is of, almost sounds like wizardry and flying and magic and things like this. And yet those things, many of the inventions today would have sounded just crazy. If we went back and talked to a farmer 200 years ago and showed him our iPhone and showed him that we can talk to people in China, that we can view animated videos, we pull up an article on cloning, it'd freak him out. He couldn't believe you could do this stuff. And that's just in a couple hundred years. So there might be some truth to these tales of much higher ages when, telepathy is supposedly common knowledge. And as Hesiod, the great Greek writer, once spoke that, mankind lives in tune with nature and lives to be much longer than he does now, and many other wonderful things. There might be some truth to these things.
Currently, we're burdened with the idea that we're at the peak of evolution and that basically, despite the troubles in the world, things have never been better. But if you put our current, your life, my life, into this context, this 24,000-year cycle, it really does change a great deal. And, technologically as well, we think we're the most advanced, despite all the anomalies, as scientists like to call them, even things like anomalies from the past, and things like the pyramids, people are still not been able to replicate that. They've tried. I have no idea how those things were put together. And evidence that stuff can be forgotten, as you say, when you have to go back, say, to 500 AD, and the people there at that time quite possibly would have thought that if they'd been told tales of the height of Rome or the height of Greece, they would have thought, that couldn't be possible. Men can't do those sorts of things. Because, we forget so easily. I'm reminded in John Boorman's film of Excalibur, which is basically telling the Arthurian story, and that's set in the Dark Ages, and Lancelot is out in the woods and he's resting and he's cooking a rabbit for his lunch. And this young peasant boy comes up and he wants to come with him, to see Camelot. And he says, well, have you got a horse? He says, no, I'll walk, I'll run. And Lancelot laughs and says, it's 7 days' ride from here. And the little boy goes, the world's not that big. Whereas we have evidence of seafaring civilizations going back maybe 1,000 years before that had been all over the world.
It's true. Yeah, it's amazing what we're rediscovering. Part of my talk that I give at CPEC each year, we look into some of the lost inventions from antiquity, and we're finding that we're rediscovering these in the Renaissance period, but we can't really recognize them as lost inventions until we do rediscover them. We find orthodontic type devices and prosthetic devices that come out of ancient tombs in India. And yet these are things that we've just, I'm sorry, ancient tombs in Egypt. And yet these are things that we've just developed, in Western society in the last few hundred years or so, prosthetics and orthodontics. Another thing is, the geared devices. Supposedly, we invented those in the sort of the great clockmaking era of Europe, 1200, 1300, 1400 AD, and then more sophisticated gears during the Industrial Revolution. And yet they found the Antikythera device, that clearly goes back to about 100 BC or so. It was found on a shipwreck, and everything in the shipwreck is related to that period. It's engraved with ancient Greek writings. And it's a computer made of, 32 precision gears, long before gears were supposedly invented. Batteries were supposedly developed by Volta in the year 1700, the first crude battery. And so we thought it was until the Babylon batteries were discovered. And these go back to, at least a couple thousand years. They're actually not quite sure of the period because the site was disturbed. They might be as old as 4,000 years. And they found there some simple batteries, and they recreated some of these and found out that, just putting in an acidic juice, you get a charge that's 3 to 4 times the charge that Volta got out of his batteries in 1700 when they were reinvented. And it just goes on and on and on, the number of things that we thought were developing for the first time that it turns out we're sort of rediscovering in very, very ancient cultures. And it lends to this whole idea that indeed history is somewhat cyclical. It's just that we lost most of it during the Dark Ages.
Have you come across the idea that the Holy Grail might have been a piece of technology?
I haven't read too much about that. I don't, of course, what was the great movie, Indiana Jones, it sort of alluded to that idea.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I really don't know what that is.
I suspect if we ever figure it out, it might be too late. No, it might just have been too long lost, any accurate information or sources, but we might well find out that it was another thing that had been mythologized as a way of trying to hold on to the idea of passing it down, or maybe like Chinese whispers, that over thousands of years, what it actually was. And this would apply to a lot of the things you've been discussing. It kind of gets a little bit gradually changed and farther away from the truth, but still with a nugget of truth in there.
Right. Well, we tend to look at things through our own yuga, the consciousness of our own present time. And if you consider the fact that we're just barely out of the Dark Ages, so we're still very materially conscious, and yet we're moving into this awareness of finer forces and starting to blend the two, and it's emerging as this fantastic electronic age where we, send information via electrons, and here we are talking, halfway across the world via Skype. And so what we might think as a holy grail, we try to put this in our own terms, our own framework. Well, then it must be higher technology, some advanced material device, versus if you read a lot of the myth and folklore about a much higher age, a Treta Yuga, an age of mind when telepathy and clairvoyance are once again common knowledge, mankind once again lives in tune with the earth, we might have a completely different idea what a holy grail may be. It may be something that is far beyond a material device. And, maybe mantra technology, something like this. Who knows? It's hard to talk about history and inventions and things like this without the bias of our own current age.
Yes, and there's a really nice point I'm reminded of that you made in the book with regards to humankind today kind of believing that we're at the peak of development, you know, physically, morally, ethically, the whole nine yards. And it's about when archaeologists have discovered ancient sites with evidence of animal slaughter, and the assumption, presumption, I should say, usually is this was sacrificial. God, weren't they barbaric? It's terrible. But you put a different spin on that as to, you know, again, we're making a lot of assumptions there based looking through our own lenses, as it were. And also you point out, well, do animals really get fair treatment across the world today? I mean, I've seen some shocking things coming out of, I won't say which country it is because I don't want to sort of like, you know, appear prejudiced, but it's absolutely jaw hanging open videos of mistreatment of animals. It was just unbelievable. And any society, even a global society that does that to other sentient beings, well, I don't think we're at the peak of anything.
Yeah, no, it kind of shows you where we are. You know, a good way to look at this and help your listeners sort of visualize it is using our own clock. If you think of time, our current system of time, the farthest back we can trace it is to ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia. That's where we think the 24-hour system with two 12-hour periods was developed. And of course, these two 12-hour periods are an AM period where we go from the depths of darkness to where the sun is at its highest, its zenith, and that's 12 noon. And of course, it really only matches up at the equinox, but it's a good average to use. And then the PM period, when the sun starts to come off its highest point and go to its darkest point, you know, it's on the other side of the earth and dark from our perspective. And this is a perfect microcosm for this great year, where it's roughly 24,000 years. It's 12,000 years ascending. And some ancients would say, you know, that we're slowly moving closer to this Vishnu Nabhi, or the seat of Brahma, this place where the golden age is in full flowering, and then 12,000 years where it's moving away. And so Sri Yukteswar would put the most distant point at about 500 AD. And so that is, you know, the great ancient civilizations had fallen by then: Sumer, Akkad, Babylon. That whole area that was so advanced, not only, you know, declines, but it goes completely to ruins, to where it becomes nomadic civilizations. And same thing with Harappa, Mohenjo-Daro, the whole Indus Valley goes from this very high point to just people living in huts near the ruins, using the old bricks now and then to make ovens. And so, yes, we've come up a little bit since the very depths of the Dark Ages, but not very much. And so if you use a 24-hour clock, you know, we're still just kind of barely off the bottom point. The hour hand of the ages is, you know, just a little bit off it. And we still have a long, long way to go. And if you think how much things have changed in 500 years, when virtually every nation was fighting one another, you had, you know, horrible things happening by governments, no democracy, there were inquisitions, terrible diseases, plagues sometimes would kill, you know, a third of the people on the planet. Lifespans were half of what they are now. And we've made quite a bit of progress in 500 years, but it's probably nothing compared to the progress we're going to see in the next 500 years, not to mention the next 5,000 years.
Well, we'll come back to where we are and where we're headed at the end. But another thing that you get into in a lot of detail in the book is that whether it's from the pyramids, and of course it could be much earlier than that, a lot of the megaliths around the world, ley lines, even the work of somebody like Tesla, there's a re-emerging understanding that we live in an energetic universe, and that's something that we would have understood. Clearly, civilizations long before us understood something about the nature of subtle energies. And as you mentioned, that's something that's beginning to emerge again. Now, even that in itself is suggestive of a cycle.
Yes. And of course, your first realization of, subtle energies, we sort of force them by brute power with huge generators and, combustion engines and things like this as ways to generate energy. And my guess is that they use much subtler ways of producing energies in the higher ages. And, we're not there yet, so I can't tell you exactly how, but there's some mysterious evidence. And I'm particularly impressed by the work of John Burke. John Burke wrote this book called Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. And in it, he looked at over 80 ancient sites, megalithic sites, pyramids, tombs, cairns, dolmens, etc. And he took electromagnetic readings he used a number of different instruments. But one fascinating study he did was at Avebury. In Avebury, there's only 66 of the original stones still remain. But he took polarity readings of all the stones. And he found the most unbelievable thing, and that is that the polarity of all the stones is aligned. And so to put this in perspective, any stone or rock that you pick up from the ground, like a magnet, has a north pole and a south pole. But whereas it can be very obvious with a lodestone or a magnet because it's strong, with your average stone, you have to take very careful readings to find where the positive pole and where the negative pole is. And of course, the reason that all stones have a positive and negative pole is that, they're all part of the Earth, and the Earth has a north pole and a south pole, and that's why magnets or compasses work. And so he did these polarity readings on these giant stones and found out that they're just kind of arranged like dominoes, where the front side would always be the positive side facing the next stone in line. And they're sort of arranged like a particle accelerator, at CERN, where they put all these magnets in a big circle to move particles very quickly. And I'm not saying that Avebury is an ancient particle accelerator. I think a particle accelerator is our, current brute way of doing things. But I do think that something was going on there that we've totally lost. And the odds of all these, of the polarity all facing in the same direction, where it always faces the next stone in line, out of 66 stones, it's like 1 in 300 million that the stones would have just been randomly arranged this way. And so it appears that the ancients were doing something with subtle energies that we still have no clue of. We're not even asking the questions yet. That's how far behind we are.
Now, you mentioned CERN, and I've had some conversations about that, and it's held up to be, the most advanced thing human beings have ever constructed. And I kind of look at it and I think it's sort of a little bit misguided, or maybe completely misguided. As you say, it's a sort of like, hammer and anvil way of trying to do something and to understand something. And I just think it's an incredible, this is probably a bit of a controversial thing to say, but I just think it's an incredible waste of time and money. But I think that will maybe be seen as such, 1,000 years from now. But right now, of course, it's cutting edge.
Yeah, it could well be too. I was just reading about the the attempt at Lawrence Livermore Labs to create fusion. You know, they've spent over $3 billion to point a couple hundred lasers at just a single bit of material to try to ignite fusion, if you will. And so, yeah, it's, you know, we're just still so early in the whole cycle. We're just barely out of the dark ages. We've discovered finer forces and we're sort of blending the two. But we're nowhere near, you know, the higher ages. And yet some of these, you know, ancient writers in India and even a couple of modern saints talk about this time again. So supposedly, you know, we lose this knowledge of telepathy, this communion with nature and each other as we go from the higher ages to the lower ages. And so when that happened last, the stories we have it are, you know, the stories of Babylon. And if you look at some of the Old Testament writings, which most of us are familiar with, it's a period of time when God confuses the tongues. So I think that's a very apt description of, you know, sort of a loss of telepathy and clairvoyance. We can't communicate with each other anymore, and we start using very localized ways. And then, according to Paramahansa Yogananda, he wrote Autobiography of the Yogi, and he speaks of the different ages. He says that by the year 4100 AD, telepathy and clairvoyance will once again become common knowledge. And imagine how many problems can be solved when you kind of really understand the other party and you can really commune with nature. I mean, it's got to just be almost magical, things happening on a whole different scale than we can now conceive.
Yeah, it's interesting that reading and writing was considered a great advance for humanity, but it's possible that it was actually a way to try and just store and relay information, you know, quite a crude way to do it, crude compared to how it perhaps had previously been done.
Yeah, that's a good point, right? Because, you know, the virtue of memory was thought to be something very great, and then that was kind of lost during the Dark Ages. But apparently a lot of people could remember a lot of things. And you have still some of the old tales, including some about the Great Year, that were passed down by reciting them. And I know that, for example, in India, they could take, you know, a couple people from opposite ends of the countries and they can recite the Vedas without having the ability to read, and they'll recite them word for word. And same thing in some of the northern communities, Norway and Finland, some of the old tales there, they could take people from different parts of the country and get them together and recite them word for word. So, yeah, apparently we lost some stuff along the way, but hopefully we'll get it back.
That reminds me of, I don't know if you ever read Fahrenheit 451, but for people who don't know, it's basically about a totalitarian state and a lot of book burning. And the people who are opposed to this take it upon themselves to become living books. And each person remembers an entire book. And so their job in life is to learn it, remember it, and pass it on to someone else before they die. And it's just a beautiful idea.
Yes. Yeah, very beautiful story and timely. I think that was written at a time when people were very concerned about totalitarianism, and, you know, the Cold War was going on. And great story.
It is. Just in passing, I want to just throw in something that you mentioned, which is close to my heart, and that's the specter of light pollution. And it's one of the bugbears I have, you know, go out and you look up at the stars and you can see so much more if you're in a rural area where there are no lights. And it kind of reminds us of the society we live in. And I think in other ages, there would be a lot less light, a lot less, you know, a lot less artificial light, a lot less artificial everything, a lot less noise. People would be doing less. They would be saying less. There would be less activity. I just think we're living in an age where doing and going and getting are just, you know, we're chasing, like, you know, rats in a maze, basically.
That's a good point, yeah. And of course, if the ancient Greeks, Indians, the ancients in general are correct, that we are much more than these physical bodies perceiving things just through the five senses, then, you know, having a cleaner earth where we can perceive things more easily is probably very important. And, you know, maybe that's just that's something that kind of holds us down in a given age, that we benefit by our technologies and advancements, but we also bear the cost of the pollution that comes with them. That's just the price of advancement, I guess. Huh?
In the book, you also touch upon a number of other areas that are kind of whole books have been written about in themselves. That's the significance of certain heavenly bodies that might relate to your theory. I mean, for example, the star Sirius, you know, songs have been written about that, poems have been written about it, and it features in myths. And then there's the Pleiades star system, which comes up again and again in fiction and in, you know, cutting edge science. And then we have the myths relating to Nibiru and Planet X and all that, you know, Zachariah Sitchin and stuff. And they're probably in that tangled web of ideas and theories and myths, there probably is some truth to be brought out from there, something that's important.
Yeah, this is something I've pondered quite a bit. So there's basically two theories on potential companion stars, and one is sort of the more conventional theory that if we are in a binary system, then it must be with a star that's close by, and therefore it has to be a brown dwarf or some very difficult to see star, maybe even a black hole. I talked to some people at Stanford that were leaning toward that idea. You know, Mike Brown at Caltech, very famous astronomer, known as the guy that killed Pluto because he found so many large Kuiper Belt objects. He sort of, you know, has made it clear that orbits of certain Kuiper Belt objects like Sedna require there to be some object out there, you know, some brown dwarf or something like that. And so, yeah, some are looking there sort of in very traditional means. And then there's other ideas that, you know, perhaps MOND, modified Newtonian dynamics, might have some merit to it, and or the solar system is moving faster than we expect. You know, that's you'd think we'd know something like that, but we really don't. It all depends on what you measure it relative to, and our measurement systems still are not that great. And in that case, we might be going around a very visible star, and the most one of the most likely candidates there is this ancient one that Sirius that you mentioned. This is one that the ancient Egyptians called Isis, and they said she brings life and then she takes it away. That sounds just like the Yuga cycle. And other cultures also make reference to this star, which happens to be the brightest star in the sky. And there's even some great modern scientific work about Sirius done by the Homans out of Canada, who found that there appears to be virtually no precession relative to the star Sirius. And this is what you might expect if we were in a companion relationship with Sirius. So that's, you know, one thought is, you know, what is this, what is the companion star, and how do you really calculate all this? And so we're doing some work there. But then there's some other thoughts on top of that that say it may not just be a companion star that is the source of this higher and lower ages, if you will. And that is where we get into this whole idea of the Pleiades. There's a beautiful saying, it's in Job from the Old Testament. I like these very, very old pre-Dark Age writings, because, you know, I think that they may have been written in a higher age, but we just don't understand the language. You know, it sounds like mythology or gibberish to us, but yet they were so carefully recorded. And in Job, it is, canst thou bind the sweet influence of the Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? And it's a rhetorical question, in my opinion, that maybe the Pleiades is this beneficial source, the one the Indians would call Vishnunabhi, or the seat of Brahma, which when we get closer to that, it produces this higher age. And so in that hypothesis, yes, we go around another star that causes this motion of the solar system in local space, but it's when we're pushed closer to something like Vishnunabhi that you then have this golden age effect, and when we're pulled farther away from it, you have a dark age effect. And there's a scientist who often appears at our conference on precession and ancient knowledge, CPAC, John Daring, and he's really given a beautiful explanation of how this works in scientific terms. He's a great physicist, and he says it's not only the distance, our relative location, but it's also the speed at which we move, and he's got some great experiments to show how this changes electromagnetic effects. But anyway, that's probably getting into too much detail there, but there's a whole bunch of science to be done there.
You mentioned different classes of star a few moments ago, and it's worth noting that in modern astronomy and astrophysics, there's a lot that we think they know that is not actually known as such. I mean, I'm not just talking about things like dark matter and dark energy, but even some of the basics that we consider to be established fact are actually theories. So, you know, there's a lot of room for maneuver when we're coming to looking at this area. You know, things are not as set in the sky and as we think they are.
Oh, it's very true, yeah. So we're coming out of, you know, a material age, a very physical age, and so we still operate under the laws of Newton, you know, these laws of physics, these laws of mechanics. And it works really well for things nearby if you don't get too big or too small. But when you get too small, then it seems to break down, and you need quantum mechanics and other ways to explain things. And on a very big scale too, you know, Newtonian dynamics don't seem to work. And therefore we need to invoke things like, if we want to stick with Newtonian dynamics, you need to assume that there's a lot of dark matter out there. And so with dark matter, it was first assumed, you know, that it's something just very logical. It's just big old planets and stars and things that we can't see. They must be, and these were called, you know, massive objects, machos. And, but then as our telescopes and, you know, radio telescopes improved, we realized that what we had assumed was a bunch of mass out there nobody could find. And so then the theory turned to WIMPs, these weak interactive particles, which so the theory went that maybe it's so small that we can't find it. And so we built up all these massive experiments to catch these tiny, tiny particles. And yet we just don't find them or don't find enough of them to make the this Newtonian view of the world hold up. And so, again, it's a big universe out there. And my guess is we're just beginning to realize how little we know. And astronomy, it's the royal science, you know, one of the oldest sciences. And yet it's still in its infancy in this modern age here, and discovering our place in the universe.
Now, at the start of the interview, we contemplated what it would take for precession to be measured by human beings. And if we're talking about a 24,000-year cycle, I noted that this would have to be measured I mean, first of all, it would have to be observed that something was happening, and the very first humans who ever appeared on the Earth, there's no reason why they would immediately start monitoring the skies, or maybe there would be, I don't know, none of us do. But the point being that it changes our notion about how long humans have been civilized, turns that on its head, or at least throws it wide open. And there are some researchers who postulate that humans have been on the Earth for millions of years, which of course goes against all sorts of establishment ideas. But there's a section in your book where you kind of address why we haven't got more evidence that, if what you're saying is true, that the more evidence of other ages. And there's a little section in the book called Where Are the Coke Bottles? And I think it's worth mentioning what that explains.
Yeah, I remember writing that. A buddy of mine brought up this notion. Here, you know, I live in Southern California. We go to the beach all the time. When I was a kid, everybody had these green Coke bottles, and they were ubiquitous. You know, there must have been, I think there was something like a billion of them or something manufactured. And, you know, nowadays, 30, 40 years later, people use cans, and the green Coke bottles have gone out of use. And we do these beach cleanups all the time. And it is very rare that you find a Coke bottle anymore. It just doesn't happen. And so if you could have, you know, a billion of some object produced just 40 years ago, and you can barely find them today, why would we be so surprised that, you know, a civilization might have flourished 10,000 years ago and created some objects, and yet we're having difficulty finding them? You know, even if you leave out massive objects, they'll be completely eroded away. So it doesn't surprise me that we have lost much of our knowledge of ancient cultures, not only physically, but just the consciousness changes that have taken place in the interim too makes it difficult.
In terms of ascending age that we might be in now, there was a lot of excitement around 2012. Quite a number of people actually believed that something was going to change dramatically overnight at that point. There were a lot of others who sort of secretly or openly kind of hoped that something would. But as we look at this larger cycle, we don't just go from iron to gold in a blink of an eye.
Well, it's true. We don't. And the changes that take place in our own lifetimes, because we're living them, they don't seem as dramatic unless you look at longer periods of time. But just to touch on the Mayan 2012 thing. So as mentioned, there's over 30 ancient cultures that had myth and folklore about these rising and falling ages and the different epochs of time. And the Greeks called them the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age. And so the Mayans called these different periods different suns. The Hopi called them different worlds. And I think that, you know, some of them try to call attention to the changing epochs within there. And so I'm not sure what the 2012 thing was all about, other than it was probably some reference. I think it was moving from the fourth sun to the fifth sun, that there was, it was an allusion to this changing of time in the great year. But it's, you know, it's so obfuscated. Most of that culture was lost. What did Cortez and the Spanish conquistadors pretty much destroyed most of it, and whatever they didn't destroy, the priests that came afterwards did. And so I think we only have, what, three or four of the Mayan codexes left, and yeah, the knowledge is lost.
So just in closing, Walter, suppose we have to contemplate where we are today and how we relate this notion of a great year, grand cycle of ages, to current world events. Because we look out the window or look on the 10 o'clock news, and it doesn't really look like the dawning of a better age. And I know we've discussed the enormous timescale this takes place on, but there's, you know, a lot of indicators that we got ourselves into a lot of trouble. I mean, we painted ourselves into a bit of a corner, it seems, and certainly there's no shortage of people calling time on human civilization and saying, you know, another couple of hundred years, it's going to be basically entering another dark age.
Well, you know, I'm optimistic. I think the cycle is definitely improving, and you know, some people would call it evolution. Things are much better than they were a few hundred years ago, as we talked about when lifespans were much shorter. You know, antibiotics didn't exist. There were just terrible problems, and it's true that the world still has many, many problems because we're still very low in the cycle. But we're going up, and sometimes it's a bumpy path. You know, on your way from winter to summer, yes, it's, you know, if you look at it in the big picture, it's you know, you could say each day is an average of a half a degree warmer or something like that, and yet you can have a few days or a week or two where things can be, you can have a storm and things can get cold, and so it's not always a smooth path, but I'm hopeful that things are moving in the right direction, and just the mere fact that we start to rediscover the Ancient of the Wisdoms is cool, and one reason I'm excited about it is because I think that mankind now is kind of like a individual with amnesia. People that have amnesia can't plan for the future, and they live with this deep angst. You know, they know something's wrong, but they're not quite sure what. It's because they've sort of lost their place in history, and that's what it's like for us as a nation, as a people, as a world. And as we rediscover this great cycle, this basic cosmic celestial cycle that drives conditions here on Earth, I think it's going to bring a lot of comfort and awakening. And so I'm real positive about the future.
Well, I have to say, when I first read your book and contemplated the possibility of this cycle being what you postulate that it is, I felt kind of sad because I didn't want to be near the bottom of anything, really. But then I thought, well, perhaps what I'm here to do, and perhaps what all of us are really here to do, is to help make it better, help speed us along a little bit, you know, on that upward curve.
I hear you loud and clear. And this is, you know, the age of the hero that we're coming into right here. And so the world's still kind of messy from the dark ages, but there's these tremendous opportunities to help it out because we're all starting to wake up. And that's a good thing.
Walter, today we've been discussing your book, Lost Star of Myth and Time. Before we finish out for today, perhaps you'd like to share with listeners details of, well, the book's widely available, but you've got some websites out there. You do a podcast as well, and you've got your forthcoming conference that you mentioned.
Yeah, the conference on precession and ancient knowledge is coming up this October 17th to 19th at Rancho Mirage, California. It's in the beautiful desert. And we all get together, get these great speakers that, you know, it's not just me talking about this ancient wisdom. It's many people that have been on your show. Gregory Sam's been there. Robert Shocks is a regular speaking. And we have a lot of other great authors and scientists that will all be piecing a picture together. And the theme this year is, what was life like during the higher ages? So we invite everybody to check out CPAC. It's cpakonline.com, cpakonline.com.
And you've also got website for the book, don't you, Lost Star? And then there's the other website for the Binary Research Institute that hosts the podcast as well, I believe.
Yeah, the binaryresearchinstitute.org. Or, you know, nowadays with Google, just Google the cosmic influence, and you can get the podcast that way through iTunes.
Excellent. Well, Walter, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hey, real pleasure, Greg. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website, that's legalizefreedom.com, legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.